Chapter 20. Santa Fe, New Mexico was a pitch-black town at 22:30 hours. While the GPS assured that they were on track to find the house to which Rafael Iglesias had escaped, the instructions were perpetually one street too late. Boxers was losing patience.
"God damn it, Dig. I need the name of the cross street before it's already behind us."
From the driver's side back seat, Harry Dawkins said, "You guys argue like you're married."
"It's a long walk home," Boxer said. "Even longer when your knees are broken."
"You've got to turn around, Box," Jonathan said. "At least we know where it is now."
They'd been halfway to Laredo to pay a visit to the lawyer shared by Connie Kendall and Bobby Zambrano, when Venice had reached out to them in mid-flight. She'd been running through some standard verification protocols when she'd noticed that Iglesias's phone was no longer pinging off a tower in his hometown in Texas, but rather one in Santa Fe. By the time Boxers had put the plane down on the Santa Fe runway, Venice had been able to narrow his location down to a specific house on Johnson Lane off Garcia Street. Johnson Lane might have been better called Johnson Alley. It was barely wider than their rented suburban. Once they'd made the turn, they were committed.
"Here's where we pray that there's no oncoming traffic."
"I don't need to pray for anything,"
Boxer said.
"That'll be the job for the guy in the oncoming car."
A beat.
"Call out house numbers if you can see them."
Johnson Lane was a canyon lined with red adobe walls. Each house sat off the road behind gated courtyards. The house numbers, if they were posted at all, were mounted wherever the hell the homeowner wanted to mount them.
"This is it,"
Jonathan said, pointing ahead through the windshield.
"This is 108.
"You see a house number?"
Boxers challenged.
"No, but it has to be."
Jonathan pointed behind, then ahead.
"That one is 106, and that is 110. This one in between has to be 108.
"What does the GPS say?"
Harry asked.
"It says it's confused,"
Gail replied. She'd been tracking progress on her phone. Boxer said,
"I'll do what you want me to do, boss, but given the hour, it's important for us to be right."
"We're fine," Jonathan said.
With a firm enough tone, even heavy doubt could be made to sound like a sure thing.
"Park there, next to the Toyota."
The red walls of the canyon weren't straight, but rather presented a dentil pattern, with indentations between courtyard gates. A green Toyota had taken its share out of the middle of the space on their left. Boxers nosed the Suburban into what remained of the slot and threw the transmission into park.
"Now what?"
"Now we find out what the lawyer knows,"
Jonathan said.
"And why he ran away to the other side of the country," Gail added.
Jonathan said,
"Yeah, and that too."
He thought through his plan. Okay, plan was a generous word, because he didn't have one. He was here to extract information, and there were any number of ways to do that. As far as he was concerned, with the Kendall kids in harm's way, none of those methods was off the table.
"Big guy, I want you to cover the courtyard, both to prevent a break for it and to be an instant reinforcement. Harry, find the backyard, wherever that might be, and tackle Iglesias if he tries to rabbit out a window."
Jonathan pivoted in his seat until he could see Gail full on.
"You and I are going to have a chat with the man."
"What does a home run look like?" she asked.
"He's going to tell us where Ryder and Jeffrey Kendall are,"
Jonathan explained.
"Call that a home run if you want. But understand that there are no walks or singles in this game. No base hits. He either gives us what we want, or he walks funny for a long time."
He let out a long, loud breath and settled his shoulders.
I hope it doesn't come to that. I really do. But I want you to be prepared.
I won't abide torture, Gale declared.
And I have no intention of inflicting it, Jonathan agreed. But Rafael Iglesias doesn't know that.
He pulled the handle and opened his door. As he slid to the ground, Boxer said,
I'll get the irons.
Jonathan wasn't the least bit surprised to find that the heavy wooden door to the courtyard was locked, with a heavy-duty deadbolt, no less. Locks like these no doubt brought homeowners a sense of security, but in reality they only slowed a dedicated team by less than 10 seconds. The irons kit was a standard element of Jonathan's loadout. The kit consisted of 3 main parts: a Halligan bar, a flathead axe, and a K-tool. Together, they were specifically designed to gain quick yet noisy entry to denied areas. The K-tool was a block of steel with converging blades on the reverse side, which, when pounded into place with the flat head of the axe, would wedge itself between the door panel and the face of the lock cylinder. Once in place, a wrenching yank on the Halligan bar pulled the entire cylinder assembly free from the door. Jonathan cringed against the cacophony of the steel lock parts clattering onto the stone pavers. Shh! Boxers hissed, eliciting a laugh. In his best Elmer Fudd, Harry added,
Be very, very quiet.
Once into the courtyard and out of view from the street, Jonathan opened the front of his jacket and extended the sling on his Heckler & Koch MP7. Over the past few years, the MP7 had evolved into his favorite PDW, personal defense weapon, for CQB, or close quarters battle. It fired a wicked little 4.6mm round at a muzzle velocity of 2,300 feet per second. The ammo weighed nothing, so he could carry a lot of it. The MP7 wasn't as concealable as his Colt pistol, and it didn't leave as devastating a wound cavity as his 5.56mm M27, but it filled an important gap. Once inside the courtyard, Jonathan noted the oddness of the house's layout. The little L-shaped structure had 2 front doors. Dirt and leaves had accumulated around the base of the closest one, and it was bathed in darkness. To the left, past the dormant outdoor fireplace and the dining area with scattered wrought iron chairs, a Dutch door with glass on the top and wood on the bottom had been swept clear and was bathed in the light of a bright LED bulb in a wall-mounted fixture. Jonathan pointed to the 5-foot void space that separated the side wall of the house from the surrounding adobe wall.
Harry, he whispered, find a corner where you can see as much as you can.
As Harry started to peel away, Jonathan grabbed his sleeve.
By the way, your radio handle is Thor.
Do I get a big hammer?
Go to your station,
Jonathan said. He turned to Boxers.
Big guy, this right here is your chunk of real estate. Do your best to stay out of sight until we're inside.
Roger that.
To Gale.
Ready?
As I'll ever be.
Here we go.
He moved the slung PDW to the rear so it was concealed by his leg yet still accessible, and led the way to the door. A part of him wanted to disable the light, but he didn't want the lawyer's panic response to go completely off the charts.
You do the knocking, Jonathan said to Gale. Let yours be the face he sees. I'll hold back until he opens the door.
Gale nodded and stepped up to the door, standing off to the side, outside of the cone of death if Iglesias shot through the panel, which they had no reasonable expectation he would do. She rapped lightly on the glass with the knuckle of her middle finger. Gale leaned in closer to the door and shielded her eyes as she peered through the glass. The move made Jonathan nervous. If Iglesias had been lying in wait on the other side, she'd have made herself a victim.
He's in there,
she whispered.
At least somebody is.
After 30 seconds or so, she tried again, a little more aggressively.
Raphael, this is the FBI,
she announced in a tone that startled Jonathan and probably could have been heard by the neighbors. Jonathan shot a look to Boxers, who shot a look down the void space to Harry. No one had seen anything yet.
Heads up, everybody, Gale said. He's bolting.
She took a giant step backward. Reading the situation as an imminent threat, Jonathan shifted his feet to a wide fighting stance and moved to bring his MP7 into play. He jumped when Gale used her new stance as leverage to fire a massive kick to the door panel, right at the spot where the lock met the jamb. Glass broke as the door exploded inward.
Jesus!
Jonathan yelled. It was reflexive. Gale darted into the house through the opening she'd made and dissolved into the flickering light of the television.
Federal officer, don't move!
Boxers yelled,
Slinger!
Jonathan held out his left hand, his free hand, to Boxers.
Hold the courtyard, he said.
Jonathan followed on Gale's heels, weapon up and ready, scanning for a target to shoot. Rafael Iglesias stood frozen in a rounded archway at the far end of the living room, his hands braced against the wall.
Gunslinger, I've got your back,
Jonathan said. Gale hit the lawyer with the white glare of her muzzle light. He was barefoot, clad in baggy gray sweatpants and a faded T-shirt sporting the Mexican flag. His thick black hair was a mess, and a salt-and-pepper mustache drooped down both sides of his mouth.
Don't shoot me, he said. I'm not armed.
Why are you running?
Gale nearly shouted the words. She was amped.
You broke into my house, Iglesias said. What would you expect me to do?
From behind, Jonathan heard Boxers ask,
Everything okay, boss?
Are you here alone?
Gale asked.
Yes, Iglesias said. No one else is here.
Jonathan said,
Big guy?
I'll clear the other rooms,
Boxers said. Over the radio, he added,
Hey, Thor, get your butt in here and be useful.
What is happening?
Iglesias asked.
Just hang tight,
Gale said, her tone now modulated.
I told you I'm here alone, the lawyer repeated. Then you have nothing to worry about,
Jonathan said. He stepped forward to make a path big enough for Boxers and Dawkins to slip through. As Dawkins squeezed behind, he whispered to Jonathan,
You might want to take a look at the coffee table.
Jonathan didn't want to distract his gaze from their detainee at gunpoint, but Gale really did have it under control. He looked down and to his left. An assortment of pills and capsules had been piled into a little dish like party candy. Half a dozen amber pill bottles littered the table next to the dish, and a bottle of Grey Goose vodka stood sentry over it all. Making note, he approached Gale from behind on his way to Iglesias.
Coming behind you, gunslinger, he said. Gonna pat him down.
Iglesias seemed to know what was coming. He stood a little taller and stretched his arms out farther.
I'm not going to cut myself or get stabbed with anything when I search you, will I?
Jonathan asked as he pressed his hands against the side of the man's chest and squeezed.
No, sir, Iglesias said. I am not armed.
Within 30 seconds, Jonathan satisfied himself that Iglesias was telling the truth.
He's clean,
Jonathan announced. A quick glance confirmed that Gale had broken her aim.
House is empty, boss,
Boxers shouted from another room.
You can put your hands down, Jonathan said. Please don't try to fight or run.
The lawyer lowered his arms, then rolled his shoulders against the stiffness.
I won't. Why are you here?
Jonathan asked.
in Santa Fe, I mean.
I might ask you the same question, Iglesias said.
Jonathan fixed him with a glare.
I own the place, Iglesias said, looking away. It's my desert getaway.
What's with all the pills in the living room?
Iglesias looked at the floor.
Were you trying to kill yourself?
Gale asked. Now her tone was downright pleasant.
He didn't answer, yet the answer was obvious.
You flew all the way out here from Laredo, and the first thing you did was try to take your own life? Why would you do that?
If you're here to find me, then you must know, Iglesias said. Can we sit down, please?
Jonathan pointed to a dark arched opening a few feet away.
At the kitchen?
Iglesias nodded.
Let's go in there, then,
Jonathan said. He turned to Boxers and Dawkins.
Big guy, you stay inside. Thor, you mind holding your post out in the yard, just in case we get company?
Dawkins spun on his heel and headed back out into the night. The archway to the kitchen rose less than 6 feet above the floor. Houses in this part of Santa Fe stretched back several hundred years. Jonathan figured that they were crossing into the original part of the structure. As much as he wanted to watch Boxers navigate the archway and bust his balls over it, he opted not to. On the far side of the arch, the floor dropped 2 steps, allowing a ceiling height of 8 feet or more. As Gale led Iglesias to the 4-seat kitchen table, Jonathan kept his eyes on the wooden block filled with kitchen knives. When they'd passed them, he grabbed the block and handed it to Boxers, who put it on the far end of the counter. That done, Big Guy went about the business of filling the Mr. Coffee carafe and building a brew. Gale and Iglesias sat next to each other on the angle of the table. It was an intimate arrangement. Jonathan stayed standing, out of the way. Her approach appeared to be working. A third front door, a glass slider, lay on the other side of the table. Through it, Jonathan could see Dawkins holding his vigil. When he got the agent's attention, he motioned him to pull the slider open. The panel introduced a welcome burst of chilly air as it opened. If Iglesias noticed, he didn't show it.
Okay, Raphael, Gale said. May I call you Raphael?
Call me whatever you want.
You need to explain what is happening. Why are you here? What happened at Shenandoah Station?
Jonathan didn't understand why she wasn't asking about the Kendall boys, but this was her interview so far, so he decided to let her run. Iglesias looked away. He didn't want to address the question. Gale placed her hand on top of the lawyer's.
Tell you what, she said. Maybe I should start after all. Let me tell you some of what we know. Maybe that will take some of the edge off. We know, for example, that you are the attorney for Connie Kendall, yes?
Iglesias hesitated, but then nodded. Jonathan understood the approach she was taking. For some subjects, getting to the truth during an interrogation was a process, a flow. When you get the subject to say yes a few times, it's as if they get used to hearing the sound of the word, and they will slowly start to provide information you don't already know. That was the theory, anyway. If it turned out not to work, there was plenty of time to work alternative strategies. By remaining quiet, Jonathan kept open the option of later becoming the bad cop.
Why are you no longer her attorney of record? Gale asked.
They wouldn't let me.
Who's they?
The police, FBI, U.S. attorney, pick one. Any of them would probably be right.
I see,
Gale said, though Jonathan wasn't at all sure that she saw anything.
Do you also represent Bobby Zambrano?
The question seemed to knock him off balance.
Who? Oh, Bobby. Yeah. How do you know him?
And what about Armand Cortez?
Of course.
The matter-of-factness in his delivery startled Jonathan.
I'm confident that that relationship is why I have been frozen out of representing the Kendalls. Well, I've heard there's only one of them left. Is it true that Craig was killed by you folks?
Which folks do you mean?
Gale asked.
The police, of course.
I see,
Gale said. She didn't elaborate.
Closing me out was a stupid thing to do, you know,
Iglesias said. As he grew more secure in the discussion, he seemed to grow a stiffer backbone.
Tell me why,
Gale said. Iglesias scowled as he cocked his head. It was the body language of a teacher confronting a dim student.
How many reasons exist to keep an attorney away from his client?
Gale answered with an exaggerated shrug. One of the most basic tenets of interrogation demanded that information flow exclusively in one direction. Questions were a common tactic for diverting that flow.
A plea deal,
Iglesias nearly shouted it.
They want to offer Connie Kendall a deal to testify against Armand Cortez, and they want me to be nowhere near it. It's the only reason. It was a stupid, stupid thing for the government to do, especially before the rest of the family was secure.
The boys, Gale said.
Jonathan's peripheral vision caught Boxer's posture, stiffening.
The boys, Iglesias confirmed. What were they thinking?
Says the man who arranged for them to be kidnapped,
Jonathan said from the lawyer's blind side. He just couldn't stand quietly anymore. He stepped around to be more clearly seen.
Bullshit, Iglesias said. I didn't...
His eyes grew large as his lips parted.
Wait, did you say kidnapped?
Jonathan said nothing, just glared as Boxers moved in closer to the table. Iglesias looked at Gale.
Are you telling me that Ryder and Jeffrey Kendall have been kidnapped?
Don't even try,
Gale said.
Don't even try. We've already been out to Shenandoah Station. We've spoken to Soren Lightwater and Bobby Zambrano.
Iglesias' face showed a puzzle piece falling into place.
That's why you brought up Bobby Z. But if you've spoken to him, then you know...
We know that you use him as a mule for drug distribution,
Jonathan said. Iglesias looked at the table.
I used him to handle packages, he corrected. I never asked what was in them, and neither did he.
I'm sorry,
Boxer said.
Who do you work for again?
I'm not saying I didn't have my suspicions,
Iglesias said. He wiped his palm across his mustache.
But suspecting and knowing are two different things.
Plausible deniability,
Jonathan said. His tone dripped disdain, as if the words were poisonous.
Elements of the law, Iglesias corrected. We can argue the nuances, but let's do that later. If you spoke to Bobby Z, then you know that I took care of the boys. I even arranged to have them sent to a very special shelter in Eastern Virginia. It's known to have lots of security. I can only hope that he's strong enough under these circumstances.
Wait,
Gale said, beating Jonathan to the same command.
You arranged for the boys to be sent to Resurrection House?
Resurrection House, yes, that's the name. You've heard of it?
I believe I have, yes,
Gale said. She touched his hand again.
Tell me what you did for Ryder and Jeff.
A cloud of suspicion fell like a curtain over the lawyer's face.
You said they were kidnapped. They never made it to Resurrection House,
Jonathan said.
Iglesias brought a hand to his forehead.
Oh, shit. Oh, no. Jesus, what happened?
Their car was attacked, Gail explained. All we know is that there was blood on the ground, and the boys are missing. Their escorts are dead.
Iglesias leaned back hard in his chair.
The priest, too? Father Tim? And Pamela Hastings? All of them are gone?
For being shocked, you seem awfully familiar with their names,
Boxer said.
Of course I know their names. I'm the one who brought them into all of this.
He started to stand, but Gail urged him to stay put by shifting her hand to his forearm. Jonathan stood straighter.
Wait, what?
What about the Ballantines?
Boxers asked. Jonathan held up his hand to keep Big Guy from saying any more. A scenario was forming in his head, and he didn't want to blow it. He helped himself to another chair at the table and rested heavily on his elbows.
Please, tell us what you know. I want a lawyer, Iglesias said.
Jonathan sighed and looked to Gail. She answered with raised eyebrows.
Okay, here it is, Raphael, Jonathan began. No, we are not cops. We're private investigators who've been hired to find the Kendall boys. You don't need a lawyer to talk to us.
Iglesias cocked his head. He wasn't convinced.
They're children, Raphael, Jonathan said. I know a lawyer needs to be loyal to his client, but your loyalty to Armand Cortez can't possibly be more important than Armand Cortez wouldn't kidnap those boys, Iglesias declared. No way in hell. If they've been taken, it hasn't been by Mr. Cortez. He and Craig Kendall were lifelong friends. Those boys were like family.
If they were taken? Gail asked. You yourself said that it was triggered by a pending plea deal.
Mr. Cortez would not do such a thing. Then who else?
Quinto Alvarez.
Iglesias dropped the name easily, without hesitation. And if not him, then most certainly Daoud Masayev. Jonathan reared back in his chair. Why did those names sound familiar?
Masayev. That's a Chechen name. Where?
Oh, shit!
Jonathan said, startling everyone in the room. He spun out of his chair and stepped to the sliding glass door that separated Harry Dawkins from the rest.
Hey! He yelled. Get in here!
With Dawkins inside, the kitchen felt very small.
What do you need? He asked.
Jonathan said,
What do Quinto Alvarez or Daoud Masayev mean to you?
Dawkins's eyebrows combined as he thought,
Alvarez is the new leader, such as he is, for the Jungle Tiger Cartel. You know who they are.
And Masayev?
Jonathan asked.
Dawkins looked to the ceiling. No, not really. It's a pretty common Chechen.
His eyes turned round.
Holy shit!
Yeah,
Jonathan said.
To Iglesias, he asked,
Is this about chemical weapons?
The lawyer looked startled. He bolted upright in his chair. A twitch of his head confirmed it.
How did you know?
Jonathan ignored the question.
Where are they coming from and where are they going? The weapons, I mean.
I have no idea.
Iglesias said.
More plausible deniability? Gail asked.
No, I really don't know. Craig Kendall was Masayev's point man on that in the U.S. That's why when Connie was taken into custody and I was shut out, I knew that I had to protect their sons.
Being the new guy on the conversation, Dawkins recoiled at that.
Protect them?
Iglesias held up both hands as if to slow everything down.
Just stop for a second, okay? Just stop.
He brought his hands to the sides of his face and pressed. He shivered,
and then he seemed settled.
Okay. Here's what happened. As soon as I knew the truth about Craig and Connie, I had to move quickly. Immediately after the arrest, the authorities sent the boys to one of the foster homes in their regular stable, somewhere out in the western part of Virginia. That would be the Ballantines, Jonathan thought. I knew they wouldn't have the right levels of security. I checked around and found this resurrection house, made some calls, and it looked like I'd be able to make the transfer.
How were you going to work that out with the FBI?
Gale asked. Iglesias scoffed.
Phoebes don't give a shit about that stuff. They punt that to the locals. And truth be told, the locals don't give much of a shit either. As long as they're in the custody of somebody, everybody's happy.
Who else did you tell?
Boxers asked.
Nobody I couldn't trust, Iglesias said. Remember how you said you understood loyalty to my clients? Where the Kendalls were my clients, too. It was in no one's best interest for those boys to come into harm's way.
So why did it go wrong?
Jonathan asked.
I don't know. I didn't know that anything had gone wrong until you told me just a couple of minutes ago. What I do know is that word leaked to Masayev about where the kids were.
How do you know that?
Gale asked. That seemed to take some of the wind out of his sails.
Do you want to hear the story or not?
I found out.
Let's leave it at that. I had reason to believe that a team was coming to get the boys to hurt them, so I had a friend pull some strings to get them moved to a halfway house of sorts where they could await transfer to Resurrection House.
Jonathan said,
That was Shenandoah Station and Bobby Zambrano?
Yes, exactly.
Did the Ballantines know you were sending them to Shenandoah Station?
Iglesias turned nervous again, as if worried he might say the wrong thing.
I had to, he said. The Ballantines wouldn't let them go without giving me that information. They are good people.
Were,
Jonathan said.
Excuse me?
They were good people.
They're dead.
Murdered.
Color drained from Iglesias' features.
Oh, my God, no.
Tortured to death,
Boxers added.
Oh, God, oh, shit.
Iglesias rocked his eyes up to meet Gale's glare.
That had to be how they found out about Shenandoah Station.
How did you know that the Chechen knew the boy's location?
Jonathan said. When Iglesias resisted, he added,
At this point, secrecy only puts them in greater danger.
Iglesias issued a huge sigh.
I need to stand, he said.
It wasn't a request. As he pushed out his chair and rose to his feet, Boxers circled around from behind Jonathan to get closer. If the lawyer did something stupid, the penalty would be swift and ugly. He looked at Dawkins as if seeing him for the first time.
Who are you?
Call me Thor, Dawkins replied without dropping a beat. Iglesias appeared satisfied by the reply. He patted the air as if to settle himself.
Does the name Hector Alameda mean anything to you?
He directed the question to Jonathan, but Dawkins answered, He's Cortez's right hand. He calls himself the Wolf. Lupo.
Yes, exactly, Iglesias said. When Mr. Cortez wants something done, he turns to Lupo, and it happens.
Jonathan felt the clock ticking, and he was losing patience.
What does this have to do?
Let me get through this, will you?
Iglesias snapped.
Good God, just let me get through it!
He paused, actually awaiting a response, it seemed.
Get through it, then, Jonathan said. Okay. There are three major moving parts here. You've got the Jungle Tigers, you've got Daoud Masayev, and you've got the C-Squared. The JTs used to be run by a man named Alejandro Azul.
He was killed,
Jonathan said, moving the story ahead. he didn't mention that he and his team had been players in Azul's demise.
As were many others in the command structure of the cartel, Iglesias continued. Quinto Alvarez, however, was still around. He was pretty much a nobody under Azul, but with all the others dead, he was left holding the pieces, and he's been looking for a way to get back in. Are you with me so far?
What are the barriers to entry in the cartel business? Gale asked. Iglesias seemed more comfortable speaking while standing. He looked professional. Jonathan could imagine him doing a good job in a courtroom.
If it were a normal business, we'd call it working capital and sales infrastructure. Remember, we're talking Mexico, right? Everything and everyone is for sale, but the prices can get steep.
You just can't buy politicians as cheaply as you used to, Boxer said.
Meanwhile, C-Squared and Armand Cortez are thriving, but there's discontentment in the ranks. Lupo, in particular, is looking to step out on his boss. Cortez is a badass son of a bitch, but there are lines he won't cross.
Like kidnapping children, Jonathan said.
That and terrorism, Iglesias said. There's big money in shuttling weapons and jihadis across the border. Nobody comes across through illegal means without paying tribute to one of the cartels. But Mr. Cortez doesn't believe that the reward justifies the risk.
Does Lupo feel differently? Dawkins asked.
Yes, Iglesias said. And he feels frustrated that his voice is not being heard. In his mind, that translates to disrespect.
What's he doing about it? Jonathan asked.
Originally, he was doing nothing more than complaining. Then Quinto Alvarez approached him with a business proposition. Quinto would pay Lupo dearly. I don't know the exact amounts, but it had to be quite a lot. If Lupo would hook him up with trusted members of Armand Cortez's distribution team.
You mean mules?
Boxers interrupted.
You make it sound like he was selling washing machines, not street poison.
Iglesias kept going as if not interrupted.
Lupo told him no way. It would be suicide to compete directly with Mr. Cortez. But then Quinto revealed the rest. He didn't want the mules for the usual product. He wanted them for special products.
VX, Jonathan said.
Is that what it is? Iglesias asked. I never knew the real name for it. Anyway, Mr. Cortez never would have gone along with it, so Lupo took it on as his personal project.
And the special product was coming from Daoud Masayev? Gale asked.
At least indirectly, Iglesias said. I tried to know as little about any of that as possible. That man is sick. Brutal.
How do you know about all of this? Dawkins asked. I mean, if you tried to ignore it, then how did you come to know so much?
I learned it all from Craig Kendall.
Oh, for God's sake, Boxer said. How many players are there in this saga?
Exactly as many as Lupo decided it would take, Iglesias said. His temper was fraying. Kendall talked to me about it because he was concerned about getting crosswise with Mr. Cortez. I told him it was a bad idea, but he decided to do it anyway. Kendall was the main router of special product on this side of the Rio Grande. Mr. Cortez's people could get it into the country, but Masayev didn't want even Lupo to know where it went once in the United States.
Where did he take it after he had it? Gale asked.
I don't know. I told him I didn't want to know.
Yeah,
Boxer said, taking a giant step closer.
When you have the capability of killing thousands with a single sniff, it could keep you up at nights if you knew where it might be used.
Iglesias thrust a finger at Boxer's.
Back off, asshole, he said. You might be huge, but I face down tougher people than you.
Jonathan rocketed out of his chair and stepped between them.
Hey!
He saw a look in Big Guy's eyes that he'd seen countless times, and historically, it was followed by a lot of blood.
Counselor, look at me,
Jonathan said.
Seriously, look at me.
Iglesias took his time, but ultimately he shifted his gaze to meet Jonathan's.
If Big Guy decides to kill you, I won't be able to stop him,
Jonathan said.
I'm not even sure how motivated I would be to try. But trust me when I tell you that he is exactly the last person to challenge to a fight. Are you hearing me? And I don't care who you've dealt with in the past. You've never met a soul you should be more afraid of.
Iglesias kept his features flat. He was without a doubt the least wimpy lawyer Jonathan had ever encountered. He might even have admired the guy a little, if only he didn't run cover for mass murderers. Iglesias turned his body perpendicular to Big Guy and addressed Dawkins.
When Lupo found out that Craig had been killed and Connie was arrested, he knew that everything was over. If the kids were targeted, Mr. Cortez would be furious. It would be simple to connect the dots back to Lupo, and through Lupo to me. My job was to get the kids to safety, which I did.
Jonathan cast a final look to Boxers and decided that Big Guy's urge to murder had passed. He decided to sit back down as he processed all that he'd just heard. Iglesias sat back down too.
So, why the suicide plan?
Jonathan asked. Iglesias looked at the table. He said nothing, but Jonathan thought he understood, to the degree that he could understand anyone giving up on life. Sure, hard times were hard, duh. But the hardest times were the ones in which you lived most intensely. Jonathan figured that Iglesias wanted to die on his own terms. If what he'd been told about Armand Cortez was even half right, death at his hands was a thing to be avoided at all costs.
Are you going to do it again?
Boxers asked.
The hell kind of question is that to ask? Iglesias said.
Boxers drew his HK-45 pistol and shifted his grip so that the gun was butt first.
A 230-grain bullet through the brain pan is a hell of a lot more efficient than that poison shit. Wanna borrow this?
Iglesias seemed surprised by the offer. He shifted his eyes from Big Guy to Jonathan and back again.
He's got a point, Jonathan said. If you want it to end fast, seems to me a bullet is the best way.
Iglesias's expression morphed from indignation to horror.
Tell you what,
Boxer said. He spun his grip again so that the muzzle was pointed at the lawyer's right eye. He thumbed the safety off.
I'm even willing to do the hard part for you.
Turned out that Iglesias wasn't that anxious to die after all. His whole body jumped when Boxers clicked the safety back on.